For seniors at home during the last lap of their lives, saving the expense and other downsides that come with residence in a nursing home. CLASS's demise is good news for the nursing home industry, since its population of residents is now not likely to decrease. As for residents themselves, they will be protected by new regulations that, for instance, require that nursing home ownership is transparent and that states monitor the conditions of facilities more closely. These are designed to improve the quality of life for residents, but it remains uncertain whether their impact will be positive. Insurance companies. One might think that insurers would be unhappy about Obamacare because of the new rules it imposes upon them, but they supported the law and hailed its passage. It's easy to see why, as it will provide them with about 30 million more customers, assuming every state eventually expands Medicaid, many of whom will have their insurance bill paid for by the federal government. The individual mandate will also deliver more paying customers and businesses to insurers. That's not a bad deal for insurers, especially when one considers that they are free to pass on the higher costs from Obamacare mandates to their customers. In case you forgot, that's you and me. Drug companies. Like the insurance industry, Big Pharma, the Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturing Association, also benefits from a massively expanded market for the drugs companies manufacture. Its support for Obamacare was so strong that it even agreed to provide billions of dollars in subsidies to expand Medicare's prescription plan and close its infamous donut hole, which is a large coverage gap that has been in place since Medicare started paying for prescriptions for seniors during the Bush administration. Pharmaceutical firms will also have to offer some expanded discounts, rebates, to Medicaid. Chapter 3. Obamacare, a Multi-Year Timetable. If you feel overwhelmed by the complicated rollout of Obamacare, you're not alone. To help keep track of the important dates, here is the law's basic timetable, including an accounting of the parts of the law that have already taken effect. As for the dates to come, keep in mind that these could change as a result of political actions, changes in Washington, and other factors. The White House, of course, could also change its planned implementation dates for Obamacare components if it so chooses, as it did when it suspended the CLASS long-term care insurance program. Implementation dates. March 2010. President Obama signs the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act into law. July 2010. Government-run high-risk pool set up to provide insurance for adults with a pre-existing health condition until all insurance plans provide this coverage in January 2014. September 2010. Children under age 18 can no longer be rejected by insurers because they have a pre-existing health condition. Children up to age 26 can be insured as dependents, covered by their parents' insurance policy. Insurance plans can no longer impose a lifetime limit on a policyholder's benefits. Insurance plans can no longer impose an annual limit on a policyholder's benefits. Phase-in begins with total ban effective January 2014. Insurance companies can no longer use rescissions to abruptly cancel policies for frivolous reasons. Maximum tax credit of 35% available to small businesses with 25 or fewer employees. January 2011. Donut hole in Medicare's prescription drug plan begins to close. It disappears completely by 2020. Health savings accounts and flexible spending accounts funds can no longer be used to pay for over-the-counter drugs. October 2012. Enrollments in CLASS long-term assisted living care insurance program were to begin. Note, class was suspended by the White House in October 2011. January 2013. Income tax deduction threshold for medical expenses rises from 7.5% of income to 10%. January 2014. Medicaid expands across the United States, with eligibility guidelines rising to an income level up to 133% of the federal poverty line in every state. A handful of states have announced that they will not go along with this part of Obamacare, and because of the Supreme Court ruling, the federal government cannot punish them financially for their noncompliance. Health exchanges selling insurance to individuals and small businesses begin to operate in each state in the United States. If a state does not set one up, some, like Florida and Alaska, have announced they won't, the federal government will create and run it for them. Individual mandate tax. Americans who do not obtain health insurance expose themselves to a maximum penalty of $285 per year. Adults age 18 and older can no longer be rejected for insurance because of a pre-existing health condition. Young adults under age 30 can buy low-priced catastrophic insurance through the exchanges. Insurance plans must cover essential health benefits, approved preventive tests covered as of September 2010. Maximum tax credit of 50% available to small businesses with 25 or fewer employees, available for 2 years before it expires at the end of 2015. January 2015. Individual mandate tax. Americans who do not obtain health insurance expose themselves to a maximum penalty of $975. Independent Payment Advisory Board, IPAB, can begin making recommendations to cut Medicare spending. January 2016. Individual mandate tax. Americans who do not obtain health insurance expose themselves to a maximum penalty of $2,085. January 2017. Health exchanges can be opened to large businesses with more than 100 employees if a state chooses to let them in. October 2017. Earliest date class long-term assisted living care insurance benefits were to be paid out. Note, class was suspended by the White House in October 2011. January 2018. Independent Payment Advisory Board's recommendations about Medicare's budget can be implemented. Tax on Cadillac insurance plans, 40% on the value of a plan above specific thresholds, begins. Chapter 4. Health Insurance. Radical Changes Ahead. To understand Obamacare, it is important to put it in the context of what was in place before its arrival on our doorsteps. When we look at the pre-Obamacare healthcare system, what do we see? One thing immediately catches our attention. Healthcare in the United States has traditionally been delivered and paid for in a very different manner than that seen in most developed countries in the world. Much of the world relies, in large part, on socialized medicine to take care of its citizens. The United States, in contrast, uses a mixed system which combines elements of socialized medicine through government-subsidized programs like Medicaid and Medicare with employer-based health care, where the employer and employee share the cost of health insurance. The employer-based system traces its roots to Chancellor Otto von Bismarck, who unified Germany in the 1870s and created the modern welfare state. About 70 years later, Bismarck's employer-employee cost-sharing scheme took hold in the United States during World War II, when the American government imposed wage controls to prevent salary inflation, as millions of men suddenly left the labor force and were enlisted to fight Germany and Japan. Looking for a way, besides direct wages, to reward workers, businesses began to offer health care benefits to their employees. Since that time, employer-based health insurance has come to dominate and define the American healthcare system, in part because benefits are provided to employees on a tax-free basis. This aspect of the system has proven advantageous, but it also inadvertently created a glaring inequity because it excluded self-employed individuals who get no tax break when they buy health insurance on their own using after-tax dollars. Other deficiencies of the employer-based system have not gone unnoticed. Critics make a persuasive case that it encourages overuse of health care. Because employees don't directly pay for their benefits, they simply use them as if they were free, not appreciating their real value. Using the logic that if you tax something, you will inevitably get less of it, many experts insist that the way to hold down healthcare costs is to tax employee healthcare benefits. Today, most, but not all, Americans get help buying health insurance. What does the nation's healthcare system look like as it pertains to different parts of the population? Let's break the system down into the important groups, highlighting how much financial help each gets with their health care. In 2010, roughly 150 million Americans, that's 48% of the population, received their health insurance with a big helping hand from their employer, which on average contributed the lion's share, about 70 to 80% of their employees' premiums. While the employer contribution, in many cases, results in reduced wages for the employee, it is still a financial benefit that the uninsured and self-employed do not enjoy. A sizable portion of the remaining population, 28%, also gets help obtaining health care. These are needy Americans, the elderly, poor, and disabled, who receive government financial assistance for coverage in the form of Medicare, 15% of the population, or Medicaid, 13%. Added together, those with employer-based insurance and those in government programs like Medicare and Medicaid amount to 76% of Americans, all of whom receive financial assistance for their health care. Most of the remaining 24% of the population are uninsured or buy individual health care coverage on the insurance market. Simply put, Americans in this group are at a distinct disadvantage compared to the rest of the country when it comes to health care. Helping those who need the most help. Obamacare will affect all Americans to some degree, but it's mainly targeted at the 1 in 4 Americans who today receive no financial help if they try to obtain health insurance. Let's take a closer look at the two large subgroups among them. Those in the private insurance market, making up about 9% of the population, these Americans are financially able to buy insurance on their own, but typically have to pay significantly higher insurance premiums, co-pays, and deductibles than everyone else. That's because they must use after-tax dollars to make their purchase. Those who buy through their employer use pre-tax dollars. They are at an additional disadvantage because they are single, standalone buyers, unable to leverage the purchasing power of a large group, such as a big corporation, a union, or the government, each of which has the size and clout to negotiate lower prices for their insurance plan enrollees. Although it is not yet apparent, the new law should eventually help lower prices in the private insurance market by giving its members the chance to buy insurance at reasonable prices in a newly created health insurance exchange in each state. Moreover, those with low enough incomes will be able to get a government subsidy to help reduce the price they pay when they buy through an exchange. Tax credits will also be extended for purchasing coverage. The uninsured. As of 2011, the uninsured represent about 17% of the population of the United States, about 46 million people in total. A big chunk of this group are illegal aliens, about 13 million people, who work off the books for the lowest wages. The rest are American citizens, about 33 million people, who fall through the cracks of the current system. Many of these are young adults who enjoy robust health, while others are low-income people under age 65, that's when eligibility for Medicare begins, whose work circumstances don't give them easy access to employer-based health care, and who simultaneously make too much money to qualify for Medicaid. Obamacare will help provide affordable health care coverage for most uninsured citizens by simply buying all or most of it for them, either through Medicaid, which will be dramatically expanded, or in new health insurance exchanges, which will be heavily subsidized to reduce prices. Another group within the uninsured that will benefit from the ACA are those individuals who could not purchase health insurance due to significant illness histories or pre-existing conditions. Insurance plans will no longer be permitted to deny offering coverage to these formerly medically uninsurable people. While Obamacare sets out to insure as many Americans as possible, it does not guarantee universal health care coverage throughout the United States. Most forecasts predict that coverage will reach about 95% of the population under the new law, an increase of roughly 12 percentage points above the current 83% level. If big states like Texas and Florida, however, follow through on their intention not to expand Medicaid as envisioned by the law, the coverage level could fall short of the 95% expectation. Of those who remain uninsured after Obamacare goes into full operation, most will be illegal aliens, who will remain ineligible for Medicaid and will not be allowed to buy insurance through the exchanges, in addition to a relatively small group of Americans who refuse to comply with the individual mandate requiring them to get health insurance or pay a fine. These uninsured individuals will still be able to use hospital emergency rooms and community health centers to receive care. Some of the medically uninsurable group may also remain uninsured if they find insurance now available but not necessarily affordable. Obamacare's impact on different groups. Obamacare offers both good news and bad news for specific groups of Americans. Here's a breakdown of how it will impact key individuals. Medicare recipients. For those who currently receive Medicare benefits, Obamacare is on the whole a bitter pill to swallow. It includes one significant improvement that senior citizens will applaud, but more importantly, singles Medicare out and makes it a special target for spending cuts. Good news, the infamous donut hole in Medicare's prescription drug coverage will finally close. No longer will seniors spend a few thousand dollars on prescription drugs only to discover that Medicare no longer covers the cost of drugs unless they spend a few thousand more. Under Obamacare, recipients will have robust prescription drug coverage regardless of how much they spend. Keep in mind, however, that the donut hole will be slowly phased out over the next decade and won't completely close until 2020. Bad news. Like most of us, many seniors are wondering who is going to pay for Obamacare. If you're a Medicare recipient, the answer is you. According to the Congressional Budget Office, hundreds of billions of dollars in funding for Obamacare will be generated by cuts in Medicare's budget over the next decade. The biggest spending cuts will come in two areas: reduced number of plans available and reduced benefits in the Medicare Advantage program, which allows enrollees to use private insurance to supplement their basic Medicare coverage, and reduced payment rates to doctors who care for Medicare patients. President Obama and congressional Democrats have promised that the cuts to Medicare will not adversely affect the quality of care seniors have come to expect. But at this point, that is only their expectation, not a guarantee. If doctors, hospitals, and other providers react negatively when they are paid less, some may refuse to see Medicare patients, making it more difficult for some to find a doctor or see the one they're accustomed to using. If you are part of Medicare Advantage, some of your benefits, such as gym memberships and vision care, might disappear. Perhaps more troubling for seniors is the way Obamacare emphasizes the need to control Medicare's costs further down the road. The law creates a new presidential commission called the Independent Payment Advisory Board, or IPAB. Think of it as the U.S. Federal Reserve Board for healthcare rather than banking. This board will be given significant power to cut Medicare spending in the future because its decisions will automatically take effect unless counteracted by Congress. That will be hard to do, as it will require a 3/5 supermajority vote in the U.S. Senate. The driving idea behind the IPAB is to give political protection to the President and members of Congress by allowing unelected government officials, healthcare commissars might be the best way to describe them, to make the toughest budgetary decisions. Because these officials won't have to stand for election before the American people, they will, in theory, be able to cut Medicare's budget in a way that is not possible today. If the operations of the IPAB seem undemocratic to your ears, you're not alone. It has many harsh critics, and its survival is very much an open question. Republicans in Congress have promised to take aim at the IPAB. But unless Obamacare is changed, there is no getting around the axe that is wielded by the current law. Obamacare explicitly cuts into Medicare's budget and also includes a ticking time bomb in the form of the IPAB, which, if not defused, will mean even more spending cuts in the future. How might these be executed? Obamacare includes a number of pilot programs to test new ways to manage Medicare through innovations such as accountable care organizations, ACOs, and other bundled payment schemes discussed later in this book. If pilots like this work on a small scale, the IPAB could decide to expand them to the whole country. Individuals with employer-based insurance. If you're covered under an employer's health care plan, Obamacare has probably already hurt you as premiums and deductibles have gone up for most working families since the law's passage. Even worse pain could be on the way if you happen to work for a company that decides your health insurance is too expensive under new Obamacare mandates and decides to drop your coverage altogether. Good news. New rules and regulations will likely improve certain aspects of your employer-based coverage. For example, under Obamacare, insurers won't be able to place annual or lifetime limits on your benefits. Check with your employer to see if you are affected by any of the new provisions. You should expect at least minor changes in your coverage. Small businesses will likely benefit from the new health insurance exchanges once they begin to operate in 2014. These exchanges will offer standardized health care plans at prices that will be the best on the market. Initially, large companies will not have access to the exchanges, but beginning in 2017, each state, if it chooses, will be able to let companies of all sizes use them. Bad news. Large employers like McDonald's, which provides bare-bones, low-cost health insurance, called mini-meds in industry jargon, to their workers, have already come close to dropping their coverage because of the heavy financial burden of new Obamacare mandates. If you work for one of these companies, your coverage could be threatened if your employer hasn't been able to obtain a non-compliance waiver which allows them to sidestep the law. Without a get-out-of-jail-free waiver, some large employers will undoubtedly decide to drop health insurance coverage for their workers, especially those that do not need such benefits to attract workers. If they do, they will have to pay a $2,000 fine per worker, but that could save them money compared to paying health benefits, since most employers pay much more in premiums per worker. How many businesses will drop coverage for their workers? Hard to say. The consulting firm McKinsey & Company thinks it could be as high as 30%, while Deloitte Consulting Services says it will only be 10%. Individuals with private health insurance. If you're self-employed or in another circumstance that forces you to buy health insurance on your own, you could eventually be helped by Obamacare. Good news. The new law was created in part to help level the playing field for those forced to buy expensive health insurance as self-employed individuals compared to those who have easy access to the lower prices that come with an employer-based plan. Under Obamacare, individual buyers will have access to affordable plans sold through health insurance exchanges, where they'll be able to buy at the prices everyone else on the exchange pays. And if an individual's income is low enough, he or she will be able to qualify for a government subsidy to help reduce the amount paid. Individuals in the private health insurance market have not only had to deal with higher premiums, their coverage has usually come with onerous requirements and fewer protections than those offered in the employer-based group market. Obamacare again comes to the aid of these self-employed buyers by allowing them to purchase insurance that comes with the same protections that employer-based plans enjoy. Bad news. Healthcare costs in the United States have risen since Obamacare's passage, affecting all types of insurance, whether it is employer-based or found in the private insurance market. If the current trend persists, premiums, copays, and deductibles will continue to go up for individual policyholders, just like everyone else's. The uninsured. Obamacare was created first and foremost to help the uninsured. So if you fall into this category, the law naturally is good for you. But there are some who will not applaud the new law because it will force them to buy a service they do not want. These individuals, however, are likely to represent a relatively small minority of the uninsured. Good news. Like those in the private health insurance market, uninsured individuals will now have access to the health insurance exchange in their home states. If you fall into this category, these exchanges will offer a selection of different health care plans, and if your income is low enough, you will be able to get a subsidy to lower the price you pay when you buy a plan. If your income is really low, you will now qualify for Medicaid, which, under Obamacare, will be significantly expanded by raising the income threshold to 133% of the federal poverty line. As a result, millions more Americans will be able to sign up for the program, and you could be among them. Some states have announced that they will not participate in Medicaid's expansion, so if you are a resident of one of these, it will be more difficult for you to enroll in the program. But if you can't, you will be able to buy subsidized insurance on the state's health exchange. Bad news. For those among the uninsured who do not qualify for Medicaid or a subsidy on the health insurance exchanges, those with incomes above 400% of the federal poverty line will not receive financial assistance from the government. Obamacare could cost you money. That's because the individual mandate included in the new law forces you to get insurance or pay a fine. Many young and healthy Americans will not like Obamacare for this reason. This subgroup of the uninsured, those who don't have health insurance as a matter of choice, will no longer be able to stand outside the system and pay nothing into it, using their own bank account or a hospital emergency room as a fallback for medical assistance in a time of need. By 2019, Obamacare is expected to reduce the number of uninsured Americans from about 46 million to about 10 million, a reduction of more than 75% in the number of uninsured U.S. citizens. That's a dramatic improvement compared to how things stand today. It will come at an immense price, of course, which ultimately will be passed on to the American consumer purchasing health insurance and the taxpayer who will face a barrage of new taxes and levies. Medicaid CHIP. If you currently receive Medicaid or CHIP, the Children's Health Insurance Program, you're likely to be the group least affected by Obamacare. But there are a few things to watch out for. Good news. One of the biggest problems with Medicaid today is that many doctors refuse to see Medicaid patients because of the program's relatively low payment rates. Obamacare tries to fix this problem by raising Medicaid reimbursement rates to Medicare levels, and thus you may see an increase in the number of doctors who will take you as a patient. Note, the rate increase only applies to primary care doctors, not specialists. This assumes that higher payment rates will be sufficient to offset other financial pressures that doctors may be forced to bear under Obamacare, which simultaneously reduces their payment rates for Medicare patients. If a doctor shortage occurs because of the new law, that will, of course, diminish or negate this potential benefit as well. Bad news. Because about 15 million more people are expected to enroll in Medicaid as the program is expanded over the next decade, assuming all states eventually agree to participate, there is a possibility that the system could be overwhelmed. One of the reasons Obamacare is being phased in over a number of years is to give everyone involved time to prepare. Each state will need to put resources in place to deal with millions of new people coming into the program beginning in 2014. It's one reason why so many states have reacted negatively to Obamacare and why 26 of them mounted a legal challenge against it. If you live in a state like Massachusetts or Minnesota that currently has generous eligibility requirements, you might actually be pushed out of the Medicaid program. If you are enrolled in Medicaid right now in one of these states and your income is above 133% of the federal poverty line, beginning in 2014, you will no longer be eligible for the program. Instead, you will be forced to buy subsidized insurance through your state's health exchange. It probably will not cost you much with the financial assistance you will be given by the government, but it will be more than what you are paying to be in Medicaid, which comes free of charge to recipients. The Obamacare Scorecard: Winners and Losers. The biggest winners under Obamacare are obviously the uninsured, who will now get basic coverage that provides essential health benefits at a relatively low cost. In some cases, they will pay nothing out of pocket. Another winner: those in the private health insurance market will now be able to buy insurance with the same advantages that employer-based plans enjoy. Other groups will likely see less positive effects. Even if a number of states refuse to expand Medicaid, the program could be overwhelmed by the millions of new recipients who will flow into it. Some doctors already are reluctant to treat Medicaid patients, and their resistance could grow. Employer-based plans will benefit from more consumer protections. Somewhat ominously, however, they will be taxed for the first time to raise money to fund Obamacare and to suppress what the architects of the new law believe has been the excessive healthcare usage associated with the Cadillac tier of coverage. Some big businesses may also decide to drop employee coverage and instead pay a $2,000 per worker fine to the government. The biggest losers under Obamacare are Medicare recipients. Senior citizens are thrown a bone with the closure of the donut hole in the program's prescription drug plan, but that will not offset the hundreds of billions of dollars in budget cuts over the next decade. And once the Independent Payment Advisory Board, IPAB, begins to operate, additional cuts seem likely. Some groups will obviously benefit from Obamacare more than others. But if the new law eventually proves successful and improves the healthcare system of the United States by decreasing the number of uninsured, providing more consumer protections, while simultaneously holding down healthcare costs, all Americans should be pleased. On the other hand, if the new law continues to drive up the price of our premiums, co-pays, and deductibles, and in the process creates another ravenous, budget-busting entitlement monster, we will have good reason to be unhappy with Obamacare. Part 2. Insuring the Uninsured. Chapter 5. The Individual Mandate. When the authors of Obamacare sat down to craft legislation that would reform and improve the healthcare system of the United States, they had one goal that took precedence over all others: reduce the number of uninsured Americans as much as possible. They had good reason to focus their attention on this group, as it has grown at an alarming rate in recent years. In 2000, about 38 million Americans were uninsured. With the economic downturn, that number spiked to 50 million by 2010, a 32% rise, but has since fallen to about 46 million. Making the problem even worse during this time, employers grew increasingly reluctant, in light of the steady rise in healthcare costs, to offer health insurance to their employees. Add this all up, and more than 20% of the working age population, those under age 65, count themselves today among the uninsured. To understand the overwhelming emphasis that Obamacare puts on filling in this gaping hole in the nation's healthcare system, all we need to do is follow the money. When we do, we discover that a massive 84% share of Obamacare spending, or $899 billion, goes toward decreasing the uninsured population over the next decade. This is the amount needed to pay for the expansion of Medicaid, assuming all states participate, and the new state-based health insurance exchanges. In comparison, the rest of the money to be spent under the new law, $176 billion, seems almost like an afterthought. Given these budgetary facts, it would not be unreasonable to describe Obamacare as simply health care for the uninsured. Impact of Supreme Court ruling on Medicaid expansion. Empowered by the Supreme Court's ruling, a handful of states have indicated that they will not be participating in the expansion of Medicaid. Right now, it is impossible to predict how many of them will ultimately stay on the sidelines, making it difficult to know the number of new Medicaid enrollees after 2014. Because of this, we have reverted back to the original Congressional Budget Office estimate of 15 million more enrollees, which assumes that every state will participate. The CBO believes that the non-participation of a few states in the short term will reduce the cost of Obamacare by about $84 billion, a rough estimate. One factor the authors of Obamacare had to consider: why so many do not have health insurance. As it turns out, the uninsured remain outside the current system for a variety of reasons, but mostly as a matter of personal choice or because of poor financial circumstances. Many believe health insurance is not necessary. Enjoying robust health, millions of Americans live for today, not tomorrow, oblivious to the possibility that a sudden illness or accident could wipe out their financial resources in the blink of an eye. This mindset is particularly true of young adults, who are often referred to as invincibles by health insurance professionals. Health insurance is too expensive. If you're young and healthy, You might be reluctant to buy health insurance even at a very low price. But there are many Americans who would get coverage if they were financially able to do so. This subgroup, among the uninsured, lives just above the poverty line. Unable to participate in an employer-based plan or qualify for Medicaid, they fall through the cracks of the current system. Perceiving the reality that many healthy Americans would not want to pay for health insurance, even at a bargain basement price, President Obama and congressional Democrats saw that they would need to do more than simply make health insurance affordable. They would also need a coercive stick. The Massachusetts example, the new healthcare system it created in 2006 that is the model for Obamacare, revealed the importance of an individual mandate. A handful of states had tried universal coverage before, but all failed because people were free to opt out. Massachusetts was the first to put an individual mandate in place, and it worked like a charm, increasing the number of insured in the state to 97%, the highest level of any state in the country. Learning an important lesson from Massachusetts' success, the authors of Obamacare focused on pushing invincibles into the system, because those who are young and healthy inevitably need much less health care than others. Their financial contributions would thus help subsidize health insurance for all Americans, because they would put in more than they take out, at least in the short term. That balance, insurance companies argued, would help pay the increased costs for expanding coverage for the poor and those who pay less but use more health care resources, such as seniors and those with chronic or pre-existing conditions. Knowing that under current law, any citizen could refuse to buy health insurance, the law's supporters understood that there was only one way to achieve their objective. They must use the force of law to compel universal participation. And so, out of necessity, Obamacare includes what is perhaps its most controversial component, the individual mandate. Simply put, it makes it a legal requirement for all Americans to get health care coverage and penalizes them financially if they do not. Under this government decree, healthy Americans will have to pay into the system for their own good whether they like it or not. The Supreme Court upheld the constitutionality of the individual mandate and defined it as a tax. But whether it's called a tax, a penalty, or a fine, it means only one thing. Non-participation in Obamacare will cost you financially unless you can somehow wriggle out of its grasp. Although the individual mandate is nothing less than a libertarian's nightmare, the nanny state on steroids, deciding that it must take care of its citizens because they cannot or will not take care of themselves, it wasn't put into the new law on a tyrannical whim. In truth, it is an indispensable piece of Obamacare, a keystone that enables and supports the rest of the law's goals and initiatives. Is the individual mandate really necessary? President Obama and his party knew that the individual mandate would generate stiff public resistance, but they included it in the final law anyway for a host of reasons. Among them, strengthen the nation's health insurance risk pool. The viability of any type of insurance depends in large part on its ability to spread risk across as many people as possible. By adding as many as 30 million of the uninsured, most of them young and healthy, into the healthcare system, the nation's insurance risk pool is dramatically strengthened. A large influx of healthy Americans, the group with the lowest risk, creates a much more balanced system than the current one. Pre-existing condition rejections. One of the most important parts of Obamacare is the provision that prevents insurance companies from rejecting people because they have a pre-existing health condition. Under this provision, all Americans are guaranteed coverage regardless of their health status. While this is a wonderful new consumer benefit, It also strongly encourages people to refuse to pay premiums and stay uninsured, confident that they can get coverage whenever they want. The only way to overcome this obstacle, to make sure no one can take advantage of the government's guarantee and sit on the sidelines until they need care, was to force everyone to make financial contributions before the fact. Offset increased costs from other Obamacare rules. The Obamacare provision that prevents insurance companies from rejecting adults because of a pre-existing health condition will undoubtedly raise insurance costs, as will others. The most important of these provisions prevents insurance companies from placing a limit on the amount of annual or lifetime benefits that a beneficiary can receive. The individual mandate makes all of these new rules possible, because it guarantees insurance companies as many as 30 million more customers to offset the new financial burdens they must shoulder as a consequence. Defer to a political necessity. The need for an individual mandate was also driven by a stark political reality. In the 1990s, the health insurance industry was among the fiercest opponents of the health care reform legislation proposed by President Bill Clinton. If industry leaders were not placated this time around, Obamacare would have had little chance of getting through Congress. The individual mandate proved to be an effective enticement to get insurance companies on board, as a significantly increased market proved irresistible to them. Not only will they have millions of more buyers of their insurance policies, the government will give the new customers money to make their purchases. While the insurance industry struck a deal with President Obama and congressional Democrats to secure passage of the new law, it made no promises about the prices insurers would charge American consumers for health coverage in the post-Obamacare world. The new Obamacare rules and their associated costs have already compelled insurance companies to pass these costs on to their customers through higher premiums, copays, and deductibles, all of which have risen since the law was passed. There is no reason to believe this troublesome trend will stop, especially when one considers that even more Obamacare mandates hit insurers beginning in 2014. Insurers, doctor practices, hospital systems, and healthcare providers are all looking for ways to control costs by pushing preventive care, outpatient programs, and other initiatives. But Obamacare does not require those efforts or provide many market incentives to drive down costs, so the impact they will have remains uncertain. First, the stick, then some carrots. The individual mandate is unquestionably a coercive stick, but Obamacare also includes a few carrots that lessen the pain of its heavy-handed directive. The carrots come in the form of government financial assistance to help low-income Americans obtain health insurance, either through Medicaid or an exchange, and tax credits that give small businesses a financial incentive to offer health insurance to their employees. For Americans who have low incomes, the individual mandate will be far from oppressive, as they'll be given health care that is something of significant value, either for free or at a price well below what they would have to pay in today's private insurance market. Small businesses will also be helped through the tax credits. These will prove less beneficial than the help individuals receive, however, as they'll only last 6 years, 2010 to 2015. Let's take a closer look at each carrot in turn. The first one is straightforward enough. Under Obamacare, the doors of Medicaid will be thrown wide open, and millions of Americans will now qualify for the program. That's because the income threshold to qualify for Medicaid will be raised in 2014 to 133% of the federal poverty line, $29,327 for a family of four in 2010, in most states in the country. We say most states because some have signaled their intention not to participate in Medicaid's expansion. The original Obamacare law said that if a state stayed on the sidelines, it could lose all of the federal dollars that helps pay for Medicaid within its borders. Right now, Washington pays, on average, 57% of Medicaid's cost in each state. But the Supreme Court has now ruled that this coercive financial stick is unconstitutional, empowering states to keep their Medicaid enrollment at current levels without losing millions of federal dollars if they choose to do so. Prior to the new law, each state could set its own income threshold for entrance into the program at or above a certain floor level, and many states choose to let only a bare minimum of people into Medicaid. Obamacare tried to strip this power from the states and make it the exclusive domain of lawmakers in Washington. It's one reason why 26 states filed a lawsuit over the issue, complaining that this element of the law was a violation of their state's sovereignty as guaranteed by the 10th Amendment to the Constitution. The Supreme Court ultimately agreed with them, ruling that the federal government did not legally possess this coercive power. The states won the right to maintain their current Medicaid enrollment levels if they choose, but there are generous financial subsidies still in place that will pay for about 93% of the cost of so-called new eligibles through the year 2020 in those states that agree to participate. This is a powerful financial incentive considering the 57% level of federal funding in place right now for current Medicaid enrollees. While resistance to Obamacare's expansion of Medicaid is strong right now in some states, it will probably fade with so much money offered from Washington. According to the Congressional Budget Office, if all states ultimately agree to participate, the expansion of Medicaid will decrease the uninsured population by 15 million people by 2019. Government financial assistance to obtain health insurance is not limited to increasing Medicaid enrollment. It will also be available for the new state-based health insurance exchanges, with the amount of the subsidy available to individuals depending on where someone's income falls on a sliding scale relative to the federal poverty level. The exchanges, which will begin operating in 2014, just as Medicaid expands, will provide subsidized insurance coverage to all those who fail to qualify for Medicaid and who earn below 400% of the federal poverty line, $88,200 for a family of four in 2010. The subsidized exchanges are projected to decrease the number of uninsured by 16 million people by 2019. Standing side by side, like imposing entitlement pillars, the expansion of Medicaid and the new exchanges raise the edifice of Obamacare up off the ground, creating a gigantic new infrastructure that will shelter more than 30 million of the newly insured under its remarkably broad and expensive umbrella. Who will be able to get government financial assistance? Eligibility for Medicaid, or subsidies for an exchange plan, will depend on which state a person lives in. If a person is a resident of a state that has chosen not to participate in Obamacare's expansion of Medicaid, the following rules will not apply. But for those who live in states that have agreed to participate, most experts believe 40 or more will go along with the plan, eligibility requirements for Medicaid enrollment will be significantly loosened, with higher-income individuals now being let into the program. Here's how it will work from top to bottom within the income range established by the new law. Those with an income up to 133% of the federal poverty line, or $29,327 for a family of four in 2010, will be eligible for Medicaid. Those with an income between 133% and 400% of the poverty line, $88,200 for a family of four in 2010, will be able to get financial assistance from the government to buy health care coverage on the state's exchange. Those with an income above 400% of the poverty line will still be able to buy coverage through their state's exchange, but they'll be ineligible for government financial assistance. Although they will be out of luck in this regard, the price of health insurance plans through the exchanges should, in theory, be lower than anything they could find today on the private insurance market. In this sense, the exchanges should benefit all Americans seeking to obtain coverage on their own. Obamacare also includes a third, less direct carrot to help Americans obtain health insurance by incentivizing small businesses to offer health insurance to their employees. If these employers offer their workers a basic level of coverage, they will qualify for tax credits. Large businesses will be pushed in the opposite direction. If they do not offer their employees basic coverage, they will have to pay financial penalties. Supreme Court ruling on the individual mandate. Supporters of the individual mandate argue that coercive insurance mandates are not new in the United States. They point out that every American who wants to drive an automobile must first obtain car insurance. Critics of the individual mandate answer that this is a flawed analogy because driving is considered a privilege, not a natural right, and a citizen chooses to own a car, which sparks the requirement for insurance. They also note that Americans can opt out of buying car insurance simply by not owning a car. A non-participation option is not available under Obamacare.